I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events and the lesser told stories, ones you might not even know happened. Find History This Week on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's a college football fight song Friday. So since Justin Buechler is going to be here, joins us now, associate professor of political science at Case Western Reserve University. Professor, we thought we'd start out with Fight On from the Case Western Reserve University band. How about that?
All right. Well, there's a political fight on right now, so that's the appropriate song, I guess.
There you go. Let's talk about the political fight that's happening. Anything new?
Pretty much polls. I mean, we're watching the polls, and we're watching for any movement in the polls, and it's tight. This is basically the closest presidential election since 2000, and that's sort of where it stands.
So I remember when I first started doing this years and years and years ago, I remember talking to people about presidential campaigns and how important it was, even with all the national advertising and everything else, to actually get people on a bus, get them to vote, give them rides to the polls, et cetera. Is that where we are at this point?
That's a big part of it. And the important thing to understand about that aspect of the campaign is that because both sides are doing it in any given campaign, it's sort of like a tug of war, and each side's efforts sort of cancel each other out to some degree. But both campaigns have to do it, because if one side gives up, that gives the other side the advantage. But they're kind of canceling each other out in terms of those kinds of campaign efforts. And it sort of reverts to the underlying fundamentals, which are still pretty close at the national level.
And those underlying fundamentals are the party loyalty or personality or what?
So party loyalty is a big part of it. I mean, remember that this is kind of a 50-50 country. We have the country relatively evenly split between Democrats and Republicans. We have an economy which is kind of complicated, because we have positive GDP growth, but we also have some economic pessimism. We also have this weird situation where we have an outgoing Democratic president whose popularity numbers are not very good. And we have all of those factors feeding into a situation which is just fundamentally very close.
Can you remember, and I'm probably am answering my own question here, but you got a former president running against an incumbent vice president where the incumbent president chose not to run. This is new territory.
Well, it's new territory in some sense. I mean, any one aspect of this particular campaign has at least some precedent. We've seen a former president run before, although it's been a really long time since that's happened. We have seen a president step down and have the vice president step in. I mean, 1968 has some parallels in this particular campaign. So we've seen some elements. It's just that basically every weird aspect of a presidential campaign is sort of combined into 2024. So, for example, in 1968, we had Lyndon Johnson step down. Then the Democrats nominated Hubert Humphrey after the campaign played out. Eugene McCarthy won the primaries. The primaries didn't really matter, so we had that complicated business in 1968 where the Democrats nominated the vice president. We had a former vice president who had run for office, who had run for the presidency in 1968 or 1960 and then lost. So, I mean, we've had these elements before. It's just that everything all at once is sort of playing out together in 2024.
I see so many things on social media. You know, one of them was, attacking the, let me get this straight now, attacking the Trump campaign for criticizing Kamala Harris as vice president and what she got accomplished, asking what did Mike Pence get accomplished during his 4 years as vice president. And I don't care if you're a Democrat or a Republican, one thing that confuses me about this is that, and in a way, I guess it's smart by former President Trump to attach Kamala Harris to the Biden presidency when, in fact, the vice president doesn't have a whole lot to do with policy, or do they?
Mostly vice presidents do very little. The only time that the vice president does anything is if the president delegates tasks. So, for example, during the George W. Bush administration, George W. Bush delegated several tasks to Dick Cheney. But mostly vice presidents do very little unless powers are delegated specifically to the vice president. Kamala Harris has not had a lot of tasks delegated to her. There is the question of exactly how much authority was delegated to her regarding the border. But generally speaking, vice presidents don't do much.
So I guess I'm wondering how you can say that Kamala Harris, I'm not campaigning for, I'm not campaigning against anybody, but it seems like the argument would collapse on itself if you say that nobody knows who she is, but yet she hasn't accomplished anything, because if she was in control of the White House or running policy, we would have known. She wouldn't be unknown, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, in some sense, it's a little unfair because she hasn't really been in charge of much of anything for the last 4 years. But at the same time, she has been a part of the Biden administration, and the differences between her positions and the Biden positions are relatively minimal. So the basic thing to understand is that presidents and presidential candidates, they're all part of a party, and the parties are relatively unified. So if you're looking for a heuristic to understand a presidential candidate, party is a pretty good heuristic. So if you understand the outgoing president, you pretty well understand the sitting vice president.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. We're talking to Justin Buechler, our friend, associate professor of political science at Case Western Reserve University. Less than 2 weeks until election. Early voting underway here in Louisiana as well. And we encourage you to vote early if you can. If not, make sure you vote on Election Day. We'll talk about the congressional races as well when we come back, which is an extremely important part of this. The entire House of Representatives, a third of the Senate up, as is the case every 2 years. And I don't know that that's getting a lot of attention, but it's going to have a lot to do with the way the government operates in the next 4 years. 620 Traffic Now, WWL.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events and the lesser told stories, ones you might not even know happened. Find History This Week on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh. 626, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Justin Buechler, associate professor of political science at Case Western Reserve University. I'm just laughing at some of the texts that are coming in. People taking this race very personally, Professor.
That's true. This is a very polarized country. People have some pretty strong feelings about both parties, both candidates. And this is a pretty intense race.
Campaigns are different than governing, though, and the government is not just comprised of the Oval Office. Of course, they got Capitol Hill and the Senate and the House. What are the races around the country looking like? And I know you guys got a big one going on there in Ohio. Tell me about that, and also about the likelihood of either the Senate or the House flipping.
So, here in Ohio, we have a very close Senate race. Sherrod Brown is a relatively far-left incumbent senator in a state that has been shifting more towards the Republican Party. So this is a pretty tight race. Generally speaking, incumbents win. But given that Ohio has been shifting more towards the Republicans, this is a pretty tight race. And the polls are very close right now. So I'm looking at the polling average right now. Real Clear Politics has Brown up by an average of just 1 point, which is razor thin. And if you're looking at the Senate overall, the map this year is very favorable to the Republicans. So if you remember how Senate elections work, only a third of the Senate is up in any given election cycle, which means that just random chance can favor one party or the other, depending on which seats are up. And this year, the map is very favorable to the Republicans. So Sherrod Brown is up, and just the general map leans very heavily towards the Republicans.
That's so, in Ohio.
I'm talking about the overall map.
Oh, okay.
Ohio, right now it looks like Ohio is basically a toss-up. We have no idea what's going to happen in Ohio. Ohio is a toss-up. But the Senate overall, because of the particular array of seats that are up, it probably goes Republican. So if you just sort of add up all of these seats that are either not up at all or that are leaning Republican, Republicans probably get to 51, just not even counting who is vice president and then might cast a tie-breaking vote. Republicans probably get to 51. So, for example, John Tester in Montana is probably going to lose, so that seat flips. So if you look at all of the seats that Republicans can hold and then they flip John Tester's seat in Montana, they probably get to 51. The House is a little bit different because what usually happens with the House of Representatives in a presidential election is whichever party wins the White House will tend to pick up seats in the House of Representatives. And in the House of Representatives right now, it is a razor-thin margin. The Republicans just have the barest majority possible. So if the Democrats win the White House, Kamala Harris wins, then the Democrats pick up seats. And if they pick up any seats, then the House of Representatives will flip. If Donald Trump wins, then the Republicans maintain a majority in the House of Representatives in all likelihood.
Go ahead. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, so basically, if Harris wins, the likeliest outcome is Harris, a Democratic majority in the House and Republican Senate. If Trump wins, then it's probably unified Republican government.
Does anybody have coattails either way?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, is the House is where you're probably going to see coattails. So if whichever party wins the White House, the coattails will give that party the House of Representatives. That's what I mean.
That's what I thought you were trying to say. I just wanted to clear it up. Thank you, sir. Professor. Yep. Appreciate your time. Justin Buechler, Associate Professor of Political Science, Case Western Reserve University. 6:30, time for WWL First News. 6:42, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Maureen Molak, co-founder of Parents SOS and David's Legacy Foundation, to talk about the Kids Online Safety Act. Good morning, Maureen. How are you?
Hi, good morning, Tommy. Doing well, thank you.
Maureen, I'm a parent, and I just got to tell you, I am so sorry for your loss, and I can't even begin to comprehend the pain you must feel. I don't know how parents that have lost children deal with it. They're in my prayers every night, as will you be, because for the rest of my life, because I can't even begin to comprehend it. I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Tell me what happened with David, if you would, please, and then we'll talk about the act.
Sure. 8 years ago, I lost my son, David. He was 16 years old at the time, to suicide. His death followed a year-long battle with social media and online gaming addiction, as well as there at the latter part of his life, months of intense and threatening cyberbullying that left him feeling helpless and hopeless. And you know, at the time, even though we were getting him the mental health supports that he needed, it wasn't enough.
Do you know where the bullying was coming from?
Yeah, it was from a group of students at his school, but it actually ended up spreading on social media. And it was just the sheer magnitude of it that was so damaging, even to the point to where we had to move schools to try to get him away from his perpetrators. But what we didn't understand at the time is that cyberbullying doesn't require geographic proximity, mm-hmm. and it ended up following him to his new school.
Mm. Did you have any idea how bad it was when this was happening, Maureen?
You know, at the latter stages of it, yes. Early on, he, as most kids, think that they can deal with it on their own. And, you know, there's a lot of shame and embarrassment around it. But by the time that we found out about the cyberbullying, he was already so far spiraling down. And it was just like the final match on a huge bonfire that exploded in our home.
Do you have any idea why these idiots would choose to pick on your son? Why is it a herd mentality? Is it a pack thing? And the people that did this, were they ever held responsible?
Yeah, that's what we call it, a cyber mob. And, you know, it started over jealousy over a girl. And then, you know, they started attacking his mental health as well as his looks and just his entire persona. And because he had this, you know, addiction to social media and online gaming, he had this persona that who he thought he was online. And when the cyberbullying started, it just really cut to his core. And, you know, he just could not, handle it. The latter part of your question, there was some accountability at the school level for some of the perpetrators, but as far as the social media impact of that, a lot of the students who saw it occurring were reporting it to the platform, and nothing was being done.
Let's talk about the Kids Online Safety Act and what perhaps that would do to prevent something like this in the future.
Sure. Yeah. The Online Safety Act, the Kids Online Safety Act, we've been advocating for that for over 2.5 years. It just recently passed the Senate with a landslide vote of 91-3, basically something unheard of in this Congress. And, it's now in the House, and we're calling on Speaker Johnson and Majority Leader Scalise to help us get this over the finish line by the end of this year. And, I've been advocating with many other survivor parents, as well as parents out there whose children who have been harmed by social media harms that are, thankfully, their kids are still here with us. And so we represent millions of American families who are calling on Republican leadership in the House to get this done this year.
What's in the bill, Maureen?
So the heart of the bill is the duty of care, the responsibility of the social media platforms to take reasonable efforts to design and operate their platforms where they prevent and mitigate a very narrow list of well-defined harms like the addiction-like behaviors that my son suffered from, promotion of illegal substances, sexual exploitation, and cyberbullying are just a few of the harms that are well-defined in the bill. There's also some safety by default, which would mean that a parent would not have to go through a maze of clicks and try to figure out how each one of these platforms works so that they can protect their kids automatically. It would default to the most highest protective settings, which is really, really important. It's what we hear from parents. It's playing whack-a-mole as they're trying to figure out how to navigate through all these different platforms. There's also some transparency and independent audit requirements in the bill.
I'm going to get back to that in a second, but what interests me, Maureen, when you said that as a parent, is that who your son was kind of got, I guess, blended with the online persona, and then as a result, I guess from his mental health standpoint, the two kind of got blurred as far as who he really was and the online persona. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's exactly right. Because of the addiction that he had to social media, it created, a situation where he was anxious and depressed because he knew there was something wrong with his behavior, but he could not control himself. So it had a grip on him that was just, it was so damaging. And he had this idea of who he was through these, through online gaming and watching these professional gamers that were continuously showing up in his feed, and the reward system, the gambling-like behaviors and the rewards that he would receive. So you can imagine that when the cyberbullying occurred, it completely diminished any type of idea of who he thought he was online, and that was what was so difficult for him to be able to understand.
It seems like almost, and I'm not trying to be melodramatic here, but it almost is as though he got sucked online and then almost ceased to exist as the real person that he was. Accurate?
Yep, that's exactly right, Tommy.
Wow. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. I want to talk more about Parents SOS, Safe Online Spaces, about the support you got from this from both John Kennedy and Senator Bill Cassidy, and about the hopes and what's going on with Mike Johnson. You got some powerful friends here in the House of Representatives with the Speaker of the House, with the Majority Leader, and you would think that they'd be able to bring this up. And if you got 91-3, if it got out of the Senate 91-3, you would think there would be immense bipartisan support for this, and I would ask, what, if anything, what's holding it up in the House other than big tech and money? We're talking to Maureen Molak, co-founder of Parents SOS and David's Legacy Foundation. She lost her son to cyberbullying, suicide. And you parents, if you have any questions or comments, 504-260-1870. I do want to address it from the standpoint when we come back of tips for parents, things they can watch for until something like this gets happened or after, until this bill gets passed. 650 traffic now, WWL. 655, 5 till 7. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Maureen Molak, co-founder of Parents SOS and David's Legacy Foundation. She lost her son by suicide in 2016 due to cyberbullying. And I can't, you know, again, Maureen, just as a parent, I could understand maybe the pain and coping with something, if a disease or cancer or something like that. Not that I'm trying to mitigate any of that, but to think that this senseless bullying, cyber bullying, that just out of meanness and spite and no other reason than that. God bless y'all. Tell me about Parents SOS.
Oh, yeah, sure. So Parents SOS is a group of parents, 20 of us, who have lost children to various online harms, like sexual exploitation, sextortion, pro-suicide content that was fed to a young girl, and also a young boy, and then, you know, a couple of our members have lost children to fentanyl overdoses that were the child bought the drug on social media platforms. And so, you know, we've all come together to represent the masses of American families who are asking for common sense safeguards and guardrails online for children, and coming together to support and advocate for the Kids Online Safety Act.
If you could, Maureen, can you talk to parents that are listening right now that have teenagers that maybe don't understand what could be happening with their kids online and what they can look out for and things they need to pay attention to?
Sure. You know, I think the most important thing to recognize is that the conversations that we have in our homes are so valuable. So if we can continue to talk about these harms and alert our children of what experiences that they may be having online that could lead to something dangerous, and also, you know, advocating at their school level for things like media literacy, digital citizenship, or phone-free schools. Those are all important aspects. But I want to be really clear that, you know, we can, as parents, we can do everything that we think to protect our kids online, but you can't protect them against something that you don't know exists out there. And until these platforms are actually required to design and operate their platforms with the highest safeguards in mind for children, we will never be able to keep our kids safe online. And it is the only industry out there that where we know that we have kids that are on these platforms. Over 90% of kids have smartphones. Until those platforms are actually required to be safe, parents will never be able to keep their kids safe enough.
Yeah, as we talk here, Maureen, I think about, you know, smoking back in the day, and you could smell it on a kid, or you could smell if they were smoking, and the tobacco industry did things to market it, tobacco to the kids and get them hooked. But this is vastly different. There's no scent, there's no smell, it flies beneath the radar. And the algorithms are just far beyond anything the tobacco industry could have imagined with market research. Talk about that, if you would.
Sure. So, I mean, we have this business model where it's designed for the platforms to keep our kids engaged, right? So as soon as they can addict them at a young age, they will have a user on their platform for life. So if we kind of look at how it's the business model is designed, So they want to keep our kids engaged. And so in David's situation, his addiction to social media and online gaming was at the core of what he experienced. So the more that our kids are engaged online, the higher their chances of coming up against an additional harm. So if we can get to the core of the addiction of the social media, then we can be able to address some of these other harms. But the social media platforms right now have no incentive to do that. And until Congress actually requires them to do that, we're not going to see any meaningful changes.
A website real quick, or people can go if they want to get involved.
ParentsSOS.org.
ParentsSOS.org. Thank you, Maureen. Again, I'm so sorry for your loss. Maureen Molak, co-founder of Parents SOS, David's Legacy Foundation. We're going to come back, talk to Jeff Palermo about the LSU game.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events and the lesser told stories, ones you might not even know happened. Find History This Week on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.